Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. March is Women's History Month, and our way of marking that on Historically Thinking is to talk about a certain group of women that might not be the first to be considered in the celebrations, an order of Roman Catholic women religious, or as lay people might call them, nuns, the Sisters of Mercy, particularly their Midwest Chicago-based manifestation. It might not seem that nuns have much to do with women's history or any other sort of history. My guest today, Mary Beth Fraser Conley, begs to disagree. She has written that previously subdisciplines of history considered sisters or nuns, quote, women of little consequence to the advancement of women in society and in churches, end quote. In her book, Women of Faith, the Chicago Sisters of Mercy and the Evolution of a Religious Community, available from Fordham Press at fine bookstores everywhere, Fraser Conley makes a comprehensive assault on this position. Among other things, she argues that asking new questions about the choices women made based upon their faith enriches our understanding of the past, whether speaking of all women, Roman Catholic women, or all of society. Mary Beth Fraser Conley is currently a continuing lecturer at Purdue Northwest, and it's our pleasure to have her with us to talk about her book. So, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
We don't want to unpack, it's not a can of worms. It's more like a 55-gallon drum of worms that's labeled History of Religion. It's kind of funny. We have History of Religion is on sort of the same shelf as, say, like History of Agriculture. But it's a little bit bigger, don't you think? I mean, it can cover everything from Siberian shamanism to Chicago nuns. So what's the part of religious history that interests you, Mary Beth Fraser Conley?
I think you're right. Studying religion can be as broad as studying a particular movement, or it can be a person or a person's faith, or it can be institutional history. For me, studying religion, I am curious about how faith inspired or informed people's lives, how it caused them to act or in a particular way or not, how it shapes their identity.
So you're not interested in necessarily the history of ideas or intellectual history as applies to religion, history of doctrine, only insofar as it shapes action.
Yeah, I like to jokingly say I'm not a theologian or a religious scholar. I study people who go to church. and so I think, you know, to steal the phrase, I'm more concerned about how the lived religion aspect of religion and history.
How did you, what's the background behind this book? Because as I understand it, this was a project, you were actually commissioned to do this project.
Yes, I was hired by the Chicago Regional Community of Sisters of Mercy in 2006. They were in the process of going towards their merger into a larger community of Sisters of Mercy called West Midwest. And a part of that was their thinking about their larger history as a Chicago regional community. And they were looking for a professional historian. And I, someone who had done work like this, who studied women religious. A call went out, and I applied and interviewed, and I was hired then, and I worked with the community.
So is this, as it were, an authorized history, or is it more of an authoritative history?
I guess you'd say it's an authorized history in that they funded the project. They gave me access to their archives. They helped me, think about the project. I, as author, had the freedom to develop the history in the way that I thought it should go, but ultimately, they, you know, I had an intellectual property contract. They hold the copyright. They had some. I want to be careful about saying that they made me write a particular type of history. Right. It wasn't that, but I did work in concert with them.
Mm-hmm. The that's very. And we never talk about the way the sausage actually gets made. So let's get to the really a macro question, the history of women religious. And I where this is going, I suspect, is where a lot of listeners are thinking, well, you know, okay, nuns, that's sweet. But what's the importance of that? This is not the Middle Ages. This is not the 11th, the 12th century. No doubt nuns were important back then for all sorts of reasons that are obscure and unimportant now. But now nuns are not important. So why are nuns important in American history? If we can call them nuns, I know that's already a gross abbreviation.
Yeah. Yes, I think it's important. I think the people that I'm dealing with, and the vast majority of women religious, that when we think about American Catholic history, particularly, we're talking about sisters. We're talking about women who are in active communities versus cloistered communities.
Okay. And a cloistered community is.
They live in an enclosure. They have very little contact, daily contact with the laity or externs. They tend to take they take solemn vows for life, and they are often dedicated to prayer for a larger cause. Usually, you know, everyone else's salvation. Mm-hmm. But as opposed to active communities, which were very important to the building of the American Catholic Church in the 19th and early 20th century.
So when do active communities of sisters who are going out and doing things, when do they begin in the American Catholic Church?
As early as the late 1700s, early 1800s. We often forget about the Ursulines in New Orleans and in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And they're like a semi-cloistered community. They taught and such. But the larger story for North American context of European immigration, you see communities in the early 1800s. I'm thinking particularly of like the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet in the St. Louis area. There are many others, but it's as early as that. As soon as we have Catholics in the 19th century immigrating to the United States, the American clergy are looking to import religious communities.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
Because women religious sisters were the ones who ran the parish schools. They came to staff the hospitals, own the hospitals, administer them. They built the orphanages. They for the most part, they educate Catholic children throughout the 19th and early 20th century, up through the 1960s and 70s. They're still doing it today. And so in that sense, they're building the church. And this becomes particularly important after the 1880s when there's a bishop's meeting in the United States in which it becomes mandated that a parish should have a school. And this is to create the infrastructure that's also sort of protective in a way of Catholics living in an unfriendly Protestant American environment. This is seen as a way to shore up the faith and instruct immigrants who may seem not to know their own faith properly according to the American hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And so sisters are very much cheap labor. Uh-huh. As well. The vows of poverty come in handy, uh-huh, not having to pay school teachers.
But also reliable. I mean,
and very reliable, yeah.
They're doctrinally and in terms of teaching catechesis and all the rest of it.
Oh, sure, sure. In some ways, particularly by the early 20th century, sisters are in demand.
Yeah.
They want them. The parish priest wants them.
So basically, even in the 19th century, if you want to found a Catholic hospital, if you want to found a Catholic school, which is increasingly pressured to do so by the 1850s, you need sisters to do it.
Yeah, I think some of the communities are hospital sisters at their founding mission. Mm-hmm. Some adapt to a need, and I think that's where the Sisters of Mercy, we see their growth in hospitals. Mm-hmm. They don't come to Chicago to found a hospital, mm-hmm. but there is a need for one. They have basically take it over the existing hospital in Chicago, and then they go from there.
So the Sisters of Mercy are very much part of this creation of a American Roman Catholic culture that exists side by side, as it were, with the main culture in response to it is a threat of public education, which is designed to Protestantize Catholic immigrant children.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think there's no, I mean, it's separation of church and state, but the Bible is in the public school. Sure. In the 19th century, and Catholic bishops and priests look to that and see that as a threat. Mm-hmm.
So they start to form this immense culture, and the sisters are a foundation stones of this culture.
Yeah, yes, they are.
Okay. As I was reading your book and you were referring to in your introduction and elsewhere, you're referring to others who are interested in nuns insofar as they're instruments for advocating a certain type of feminism or a certain type of I don't know what to say, something that's recognizable as modern social activism. Let's put it that way. That doesn't seem there, and in a way, it's the sisters are an instrument for that. They're interesting insofar as they're an instrument for that. You don't seem to have that attitude at all, or am I wrong?
Well, I think I think it's important to not put on, people in the past, particular political or activist sensibilities when they didn't have them. We can describe them as acting in maybe feminist ways, but I think if we look at the contemporary examples of sisters activism, I'm thinking particularly the nuns on the bus and such. Yeah, these are feminist women. But if you look into, even if you were to look mid 20th century or 100 years earlier, what they considered activism, or how they should be acting, was motivated not necessarily for women's advancement in the way that we would think of it as women's rights or suffrage. They're looking to see how they can alleviate the sufferings or how they can provide education for a largely immigrant population or the children of immigrants. And so in a sense, that's activism, but they wouldn't necessarily call it that. And the other side of that is that these are women who actively believed and supported the mission of the church, which was not necessarily seeking to liberate women as we would think of it in the late 20th century. So they're looking to support an institution to maintain and to pass on values that championed the idea of motherhood and supporting being supportive of men. Mm-hmm. You do have practical women who see that young girls need an education, that they need training for jobs, that they should be well educated, that college is important. You have this, but they can go hand in hand with mm-hmm. the supporting of the mission of the church.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as simple as straightforward activism.
Let's get to the actual subject. Let's get to the Sisters of Mercy. Who are they? Who founded them? When? Where? And what were they for?
Well, they're founded by Catherine McCauley in Ireland, in Dublin, particularly. And they're founded in 1831 She has this idea that there is need for particularly children and women of good character in Ireland who needed support, and she had the money and the ability and the building to do this, and she eventually forms her own religious congregation, the Sisters of Mercy.
I noticed that she was from a Protestant family.
Well, she's sort of from a Protestant family. I mean, her parents, she was Catholic, baptized Catholic. Okay. Her aunt and uncle were Quakers.
Oh, my.
And, of course, the story is that she stayed strong with her Catholic faith when it was, you know, when it was challenged. And
this was in Dublin?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so she does form a collection of women are living together in her, after she's inherited the house and the money and they come to form a religious community with Catherine McCauley as the foundress and head of it. Quickly, we see new houses being formed in Ireland, which leads to missions to other parts, to England and ultimately to the United States.
What does it take to be a foundress? I mean, what does she have to do to be approved by the bishop and so on?
In her case, she had the local bishop was supportive of her. She to continue in her mission, she ended up going to the Presentation Sisters, and she went through formation. She was older. She was in her 40s, I think.
Okay. And the Presentation Sisters are another order of sisters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so she goes through formation process in Ireland. She essentially professes vows, but in her own. Now this community that she's created, she then goes and starts the formation process over. So but in the process of all that, she's having to she with the bishop is writing the constitution.
Okay.
That goes to Rome, takes a long time, but it gets eventually approved. So the Sisters of Mercy have papal approbation, which means that they are approved by the Vatican, and that from there they start to get vocations, I guess.
What's the what makes them different? She had been in the Presentation Sisters, and that's where she took vows. What makes the Sisters of Mercy different from any other order of sisters? What makes them distinctive enough that makes a bishop say yes? Well, that we could use another one of those.
Well, Ireland needed communities of sisters like the Sisters of Mercy. They needed them. They needed them just as much as the United States needed women sisters to basically build the faith. But what makes them specifically different? Their vows and a lot of their constitution is very similar to the Presentation Sisters. And I think, you know, there's a lot of similarities to other active sisters communities. That are created about this time.
Mm-hmm.
They all take vows of poverty, of chastity, and obedience. Some argue that the Sisters of Mercy take a fourth vow of service to women and children, specifically.
Some argue, do they or don't they?
Well, they do, but this gets into canon law, which is not my area.
Okay. That
it's not a fourth. It's not technically a fourth vow.
Okay.
It's in their vows to say that.
Yes.
But it's not technically a fourth vow.
Okay. But for the from the outside of this perspective of canon lawyers, from those outside looking in, they do make a vow to the. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And to lifelong, you know, service to the community as well.
Mm-hmm. So they then, if they're going to England and to America, they're following the Irish diaspora then, or.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, they are. I think, in particular, the movement to the United States. It's the Pittsburgh bishop goes back to Ireland. He specifically asks for the Sisters of Mercy. I think there's a cousin connection somewhere in there.
Okay.
And he gets the first group to come to Pittsburgh in 1843, and there's only six of them who come. And that's the foundation or the nucleus of the Pittsburgh community. They come to Chicago. The bishop, the first bishop of Chicago, his last name is Corder. He is in New York when this community arrives from from Ireland and says, when you have, basically, I want you to come to Chicago too. Mm-hmm. And so that's why 3 years later, Francis Xavier Ward takes the five from Pittsburgh to Chicago.
And what year is that?
They arrive in Pittsburgh in 1843. They go to Chicago in 1846.
Gosh, as early as that.
Yeah, they are the first religious community of women to go to Chicago.
Okay. And, well, I guess other than in St. Louis, the first religious community in Illinois or the Old North, women religious community in the Old Northwest? Just about. More or less. Okay.
I wouldn't want to say that.
No,
for certain.
You wouldn't. No, you're.
I think there are enough.
You're much enough. More cautious than I am. This is just a podcast. But okay, so they're extraordinarily early, before just 14 years after really Northern Illinois has been taken away from the Soak and the Fox and the Potawatomi,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It's been opened up and Chicago is growing and all the rest of that. The railroad's barely in Chicago. It hasn't even gotten to Chicago yet.
Right.
By
yeah.
the time they arrive. Why do young Catholic women join the Sisters of Mercy or any other order of sisters in the 1840s, 1850s, in the 19th century?
Well, for Catholic women in the 19th century, this is one of the things that you can do. You know, there's all this wonderful womanhood ideology that's inculcated into women, whether they're Protestant or Catholic, about piety and motherhood. For Protestant women, your choices are marriage or mm-hmm. or spinsterhood. You know, this is your choice.
Yeah.
For Catholic young women, it's motherhood, of course, but then you have this higher ideal of religious life. You know, this in the 19th century, I think up until Vatican II, when it's declared canonically different, you're in a higher plane of existence. I mean, yeah, you're the bride of Christ. You're special in a sense. This is a calling from God. In a practical sense, religious life offered a lifelong work and education and work that, you know, you may not get, you know, in your average young woman in the 19th century. I mean, if you think about the rate of education, young women aren't getting high school degree, you know, diplomas and going on to, in small numbers, going on to college until the second half of the 19th century. And for Catholic young women, this definitely doesn't happen until the end of the 19th century. And so this is a viable, you know, alternative. Now, does every family want their daughter to be a sister? Not necessarily. It's always a source of pride if you do have a nun in the family, you know, or a priest in the family. I think, there's famous families like that. I think I mentioned the sisters in Iowa, the Fanning sisters. There's four of them. They all come from Ireland. It was something, you know, the women who come from Ireland, you know, there's not a lot of options in Ireland for them for marriage, particularly because of the famine and so and such. And religious life is a choice in Ireland as well. But even that's a hard choice. And so they're coming to the United States. They're being recruited. In the United States, it's definitely a source of upward mobility.
Oh, really?
And to a certain extent, but we can't discount. It's easy. This is where it's easy to say, "Oh, well, this is a feminist choice."
Right, right.
They're choosing not to get married and have children, which is, you know, you're facing when you're in the 19th century. There's a lot of problems with childbirth and, you know, lifelong work there. But it's easy to say, "Oh, this is a feminist choice," when it's. We can't forget that there's also it's a faith choice mm-hmm. that there's a calling, a vocation, and they want that as well.
So, like most human choices, it turns out to be really complicated.
Yes.
What if in the 19th century, and this changes a little bit, of course, then a lot during the 20th century. But how is a Sister of Mercy in the Chicago? Is it the region at the time, or what?
They up until 1929, there's a different communities, different houses, okay. Mother houses. It's in 29 when they become a province.
Got it.
When the Sisters of Mercy, instituted general system on their community.
Mm-hmm. So the Mother House of Chicago, how does it educate the young women that are coming to it? And what's the process that they go through? I found that fascinating.
Are you talking about formation?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's in the 19th century up through, this is a similar process up through the 20th century. But a woman becomes, it's like a trial period of 6 months to a year. And then after that, you're accepted into the community votes on you, basically, to use sort of lay terms. But there, you get approved by the congregation and you continue on the novitiate, or novice training. And this could be, it's about a year or so. And then a woman will take her first vows, mm-hmm. her first profession.
What does that mean?
They become a part of the community, and it's there's still time to leave.
Okay.
I guess.
So they've taken a vow to be a good member of the community a year and a half after arriving.
Something like that. Okay. Yeah. Right. And it can vary depending on the circumstances, that timing, mm-hmm. but it's usually pretty regimented. Mm-hmm. And then after that, a person will take their final vows, and that's in your, you can't get, you have to, if you leave, it's, you have to have, you need to be dispensed okay. from by the church. But yeah, then they take their final vows after a couple more years. It can take up to 6 years.
Okay. What are they doing in those 6 years?
Initially, there's a lot of, it's a lot of study and prayer.
Mm-hmm.
After the first vows, first profession, there's you become more involved in ministry.
Mm-hmm.
You can be put into a classroom or in our hospital ward. Get more training. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's literally a formation process by which they're called bands, the groups of women who came in together, entered at the same time. It's a band of women who they're being formed by study, reading the spiritual writings of Catherine McCauley, other spiritual writings. They're not going to get a lot of theology in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the changes of the 20th century. The 1950s and 60s, there's actual more theological study and formation.
Are some directed into teacher training and some into nursing, insofar as that's taught in the 19th century?
Yeah, yeah. I interviewed a woman in Chicago who had wanted to be a missionary,
mm-hmm.
wanted to be a nurse. But when she entered, she was told she'd be a teacher because that's what was needed.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yes. I mean, for the larger Chicago province, there's a lot of teaching that was needed, not as much as nursing, but that was also something that was needed. But a lot of women, young women, were at a young age, were put into classrooms, and often you get this sort of popular story of the 1950s, mm-hmm. sister in a classroom with 60 children,
right.
alone, and that was true and to a certain extent, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much more complex.
We should get back to that
okay.
when we get a little farther, because I know that that's sort of an engraving. If we had a buck for every person, Roman Catholic, who had a bad experience with a nun,
mm-hmm.
We could be independent scholars very easily, I think.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how everyone sort of has the same exact stories. That's either they're copying other stories or there's a remarkable unanimity of behavior.
Really bad Catholic children.
Yes, very bad. They must have all been awful. What struck me when I was looking, was reading the book, is the Sisters of Mercy seem to have been somewhat rigorous. I was looking at their dress. I don't know if that's standard at the time, but it's certainly a very distinctive dress. And they're also referred to as the Walking Sisters, which has a story behind it. Why are they called the Walking Sisters? And are they successful because of their rigor in the 19th century in Chicago?
Well, in terms of the Walking Sisters, they get that name in Ireland. They went out in pairs, always. As much as religious life is, they're not enclosed. They're not cloistered like nuns. They were not supposed to go out alone. The sisters were always seen in walking in pairs. And there's a whole host of rules about, you know, particularly as you get into the 20th century about driving in cars with men and so forth. But so that's why they're called the Walking Sisters. In the 19th century in Chicago, you would see them walking about together. And if you think about their dress, it's very distinct from what your average woman would be wearing walking about the street. And so people paid attention. It calls attention to them. Their dress is, you know, it's
a very capacious black habit.
Mm-hmm. That's typical in some ways. I mean, all the habits are, there's a degree of difference between habit, between communities, but there's that is not, it's a very typical kind of habit.
But of course, in 1846 Chicago, it's revolutionary.
There's the stories of the, you know, the communities that are being found in antebellum America, where women would travel in secular dress until they got to their convent, so they would not be harassed along the way. And it was for Protestant America, it was very weird in some ways exotic.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What is this habit hiding? And for the habit was intentional. There's a point of the anonymity or this desire to avoid singularity or individual identity. It's the community in service of God.
Right. I was struck by thinking about this The way to Protestant America at the time, it must have been as challenging as the burqa in modern France, or even here, for that matter. There is the burqa, of course, you only see eyes. If that, here, of course, the wimple is tight enough that you just see the chin to the forehead. That's it.
And particularly when Protestant America in the antebellum period was, you know, could get themselves excited about the escaped nun stories, Maria Monk.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that story on the podcast notes. So give a reference to people who are wondering what the heck that Maria Monk is about.
Yeah.
So they grow, and they are, what sort of infrastructure, what sort of network are they establishing? What have they established by, say, the 1920s?
By the 1920s, they're, for the Chicago regional community, there, which will become one in 29, they're establishing throughout Chicago. There are two separate foundations in Chicago that that are staffing parish schools. They have academy or high schools for young women. They have a hospital in Chicago. In out places like Aurora, Illinois, they have they have other hospitals. They are providing care for mentally ill. In Iowa, their ministry is more focused on hospitals in Davenport and Iowa City, but they're also teaching. They open schools throughout small communities in Iowa. When they go from Iowa to Wisconsin, again, they're establishing parish schools. It's free education. Parish schools are free education for kids. They established the high school, the academy schools, the paid schools. Again, there's a they established hospitals in Janesville and and so forth. So but the other thing that they're doing, which is really important, is these houses of mercy, and they are homes for young women, and they make the distinction of being homes for women of good character versus what someone like the community, like the Good Shepherd Sisters, who created homes for fallen women. Mm-hmm. So they're spreading throughout spreading westward throughout this particular area and covering the bases.
So who are in these homes then? These are not homes for fallen women or women of good character. These are just homes for young girls who have no place to go, or
it's women. It becomes, by the second half of the 19th century, they become places where women who have come to the city or who are working. This is what Catherine McCauley has established in Dublin at the beginning. There are people who are working in the city who don't have the money to live live independently.
Got it.
And so they need a place that they won't fall into sin and vice or be seduced into vice. They need to be protected.
It's like there's a neighborhood in Davenport, come to think of it, mm-hmm. which is where all the cigar rollers, also a lot of them were women, and a lot of them also had a double life. They rolled cigars by day and were part-time prostitutes by night.
Yeah,
and so it's the cigar roller district turns out to also be the brothel district.
A good comparison would be the YWCAs established. They're just places, and the homes for women in Milwaukee in particular. There's two there that are up around where Marquette developed. Mm-hmm. And one still exists today, and that one today provides it's not a halfway house, but it provides a home for women who are on that borderline of they need the support of affordable housing like that. Mm-hmm. And the care, they provide social welfare and such.
Yeah. That's great. That's great because it emphasizes there's a difference. I mean, it's hard to find a good, reasonable, cheap apartment in mm-hmm. the 1880s, 1890s. But there are boarding houses. This is sort of an approved church run boarding house in a way. It's boarding houses are, nasty places sometimes, especially for single women.
Definitely.
And so this is an okay. And it shows also, I think, it's a really a dazzling infrastructure that they create that is Catholic Chicago of 1900. It's huge. It they have everything.
Yeah, and I think this is where the Catholic culture of the 20th century comes in, and particularly with Chicago. I mean, Chicago people identify with parish. You know, which parish are you from for a time? And even when there's, Catholics are not, there people are not attending Catholic churches, they like the idea of sending their children to the parish school. And I think there's a particularly on the South Side for a time, the Sisters of Mercy have a strong affiliation with the South and West Side of Chicago. There's some degree with the North, which made it interesting when I was working there. The Chicago White Sox, Chicago Cubs rivalry was real.
It maps very nicely then over there. That's hilarious.
Yes, I think I'm getting away from the question.
Yeah, you are. Right, but it's they're creating Catholic Chicago.
Yes.
You describe the watershed. You do not point the watershed in the history of the Sisters of Mercy in the 1960s with Vatican II, which people might assume. Instead, you really describe it as beginning in the 1920s. Why and how?
I think I think Vatican. We shouldn't throw away Vatican II. I think it's an important. The 60s are definitely important, and it's almost as if it's the manifestation of all that's happened. You know, it's like the tipping point in some ways. But I think it's even more important to look in the preceding decades. At the end of the 20s, early 30s, you start to see the building of more monastic style religious life. It's much more structured. It's much more regulated, and this comes from the revision to the Code of Canon Law in 1917, and the revision of their constitutions, which brings this amalgamation, this creation of the generalate system that unites a lot of the Mercy foundations at that point. And there's much more uniformity. But there's also this growing demand on the community to staff these schools. By the late 40s, early 50s, all religious communities of women are struggling with this demand and the need for, you know, fully preparing their members for their ministry. And it's the sister formation movement that starts in the early 50s. It's this call to have the sisters, the young women, get their college education before they enter the classroom or the hospital ward or whatever it is their ministry is.
So let me tease this apart a little bit.
Okay.
There's a growing, I guess, population growth of Catholics in the United States.
Yeah.
There's more demand for Catholic schools.
Yeah.
There's more demand for Sisters of Mercy to be teachers than there was before.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there is Catholics are feeling the pressures of professionalization. They feel they have to have their teachers trained up to a certain standard that equals that in the public schools, or approaches that in the public schools.
That was something that was starting in before that. I think the progressive era changes. You know, that's they're feeling but you'll have a 19-year-old newly, you know, like novice in the classroom who doesn't have her college degree yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes her 10 years to get going to school on the weekends or in the summers to get her college degree. But with the changes to healthcare, with the changes to in schools, and certifications, all these things, there's growing demand that they have their degrees.
Before they start their novitiate.
No, so look at it this way: like the woman enters, when she will then be sent to the college.
Okay.
And in the case of the Mercies, it's their own college.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, they may be needing some kind of graduate degree, mm-hmm. whether it be in pharmacy or in hospital administration or, you know, what have you. And so you start to see this desire to have these degrees sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have, instead of it taking 10 years to get the college degree or 15 or 20 years, it's going to be, you know, the typical 4 to 5 years.
So how does this affect the sisters? Negatively, positively, how?
It's positive. It's the worry that if you have women reading,
uh-huh.
they're going to, you know, become smarter people or more, you know, more vocal people, and the communities are in a sense having fully formed adults, uh-huh. you know, going out into the communities. The sister formation movement gives the larger, a particular congregation, more tools at a time when there are some changes within the larger church in terms of theology. And so as the church is moving towards Vatican II, the religious communities are moving towards Vatican II. So they're starting to read all these, you know, they're starting to get a little glimpses of this changing theology. Plus, there's this cardinal, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, I always do, Sunens, he wrote this book called The Nun in the World, in which he says, you know, women should leave, and men should leave their cloistered life, their convents, and go out into the streets where they're needed. And this is really appealing to a lot of women in active communities like the Mercies. And they want, they're thinking about this if you want to talk about Chicago, their traditional population of white Catholics, and their movement out of the old neighborhoods, whether it be north or, you know, beyond the city into suburbs, and the changing dynamic of Chicago's population, and they're serving different people as the parish school stays where it is, and they're just being infected by all that's going on around them, whether it's, you know, theology or if it's, you know, political science or, you know, current events or what have you. And they're starting to think about the limitations or the structures of their life. Mm-hmm. They're bound by all these rules that seem silly. Mm-hmm. If we were to think about them from our perspective, like, what do you mean you have to ask your local superior for a stamp, mm-hmm. if you want to mail a letter that you have to give to her unopened, to her to check before mm-hmm. to seal and so forth, and or you can't go drive in a car that your father is driving, mm-hmm. because it's not allowed. You know, you can't attend the evening function at your parish church, you know,
so
because
all these things are simmering away, mm-hmm. even prior to the events of Vatican II and the outgrowth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when that comes along, it falls on to mix our metaphors, they're simmering away and therefore falling on a fertile field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
What's the next step? I mean, where do things go from there? I mean, I know, I've read the book. There's a rapid decline in the numbers of the Sisters of Mercy. Okay, you're going to protest.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a rapid decline,
okay.
But
it's a long decline.
What was that?
It's a long decline.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of dramatic things happening in the 60s in some senses, like come to a point in the with Vatican II, the communities are charged with revising their constitutions, and so there's a whole discussion about how we're going to do ministry, how we're going to do community living, how we're doing formation, you know, spiritual life, and so there's a lot of internal experimentation and a lot of discussion. The religious government itself starts to change, the changes aren't a groundswell from below. It's sort of a meeting in between of the government and membership, and in all that, women are saying to themselves, you know, I have this calling from God to live this life. But I don't have to do it in a community. And so you see people leaving, but you also see people staying. The mm-hmm. trouble is, in terms of numbers, is that particularly the Chicago province mercies are not getting a lot of people entering. Mm-hmm. And that's, so you have these big numbers of people leaving, you know, tens or twelves a year, but you don't have anybody coming in, mm-hmm. and then from the 60s and after the 60s into the 70s, there's really nobody coming in, uh-huh. And that's when you start to have this sort of, well, now we're getting older, and mm-hmm. the community starts to decline in number because of lack of people coming in and people starting to pass away.
We just are about out of time, so mm-hmm. I want to move to sort of some concluding thoughts. You suggest that in some ways their history is not so different from that of other religious communities, that the habits, the wimples, the exoticness to Protestants, agnostics, atheists, about nuns and sisters, that conceals real similarities. What do you think are some of the similarities? I mean, how is their history the same of the history of other religious communities?
When you say religious communities, do you mean Catholic religious communities, or do you mean other just plain religious communities?
I mean plain religious communities.
I think there's some similarities. What in some sense makes them different is this vow, the lifelong commitment to this religious life. Mm-hmm. But you do see a lot of similarities, and I think, you know, like there's the deaconess movement that comes in the the second half of the 19th century, where I think it was particularly strong with the Methodists and Presbyterians, the Lutherans, that this women would come and live in community and do, in a sense, social work, live wearing a common dress, mm-hmm. and such. And that's very similar. The thing that is a little bit different is that they could leave and marry and such. I think there's a lot of much more interesting community religious life in the Shakers.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it's a lot like a medieval, you know, double monastery where you have
absolutely
women and men together in one place. I mean, I you could even go so far as to say the Salvation Army workers are like is a religious community. It's that shared agreement. It's that shared sense of we are we've professed these vows or this promises. Mm-hmm. Want to go there to a particular religious mission that I think goes across denomination. I think the community life, I mean, it's become the idea of communal living has come back in the last few decades too,
mm-hmm. yeah,
among Protestant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And as long as that's the case, then people are going to be looking for lessons and so on from such people like the Sisters of Mercy.
Oh yeah, it's one of those reasons I think motivated them to want to have this book written. Mm-hmm. That people know their history and it could be, in a sense, a sort of vocational, not vocational in the classic sense, here we'll get people joining up, but mm-hmm. sort of like, here's the spiritual life, here's this ministerial life that could inspire you.
My guest today has been Mary Beth Fraser Conley. Her book is Women of Faith, the Chicago Sisters of Mercy and the Evolution of a Religious Community. It's available from Fordham University Press in New York. And Mary Beth, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Limbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.